Hi, everyone, and welcome to the AI Innovators Podcast. I'm Rob May. I'm the CEO of Nova and a very active angel investor in the AI space. And the purpose of this podcast is to interview people that are doing really interesting things with AI, whether it's deep technology, applications, new business models, etc. And my guest today is Alex Wilchko, who's the founder and CEO of Osmo. Alex, welcome to the podcast.
Rob, it's really wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I want to jump right into this because you have one of the most fascinating businesses that I've seen in the AI space. You teach machines to smell. Let's dig into that tech and talk about like how does it work and how did you train a machine to do this?
Yes, it's a bit of a mind bender when you first come across it because we haven't given machines a new sense for quite some time. So we've successfully done this for vision and for hearing and to some extent for touch. I mean, we all use keyboards as a bit of a glib example, but vision and hearing completely digitized. But those things really happened a generation or more ago, right? The late 60s, early 70s is when vision kind of the fundamentals were in place for digitizing it. So it feels like something lost away in time, this idea that we can add a new sensory modality to computers. But there's a playbook, right? So in order to understand how to digitize a sense, you can think about how it was done for vision. And there's three fundamental pieces. There's reading the world, right? So taking the world in, turning it from atoms or photons into bits. Then there's mapping, which is to understand those bits, to manipulate them. So think of JPEG, Photoshop, those kinds of things, compression, transmission. So there's reading, taking in the world, mapping, manipulating, understanding, compressing. Then there's writing, taking the bits and turning them back into the real world, back into atoms, right? So printers, monitors, display devices of the kind. And for, you know, hearing, just to make the analogy complete, it's, you know, microphone, and then it's audio editors, and then it's speakers, right? So you have to have that full arc from in to manipulate and understand to out. Smell is no different, right? We have a nose. It takes air in. It listens for the molecules that we breathe in. And those signals, the identities of those molecules, the amounts of them, that's the signal that is transmitted to our brain, although it's heavily mutated even in the nose. And then our brain processes it. We associate it with memories. It triggers emotions. It triggers memories. And then for our body actually emits smells all the time. It's not in a closed loop necessarily. Our bodies also don't do that for vision, right? The input systems are different than the output systems. But that's how it works, right? So what Osmo is today is a company that's on the mission to put all these pieces together. And we started in Google Research, actually. So I was a research leader in what was then called Google Brain for about 6 years. And that's now called Google DeepMind. But I did a few things there. I led a compiler team in TensorFlow. I did applied AI research. And then the main thing I did was I started the digital olfaction group there. And the mission was the same, which was, you know, can we actually teach computers to smell? And what we focused on in Google Brain was really one very simple to state, but very difficult to solve question. And it sounds almost trivial when you just boil it down. But it ended up being one of the hardest parts and the main unlock, which has created this whole line of work that my life is dedicated to now. And it's this. If you can draw a molecule structure on a whiteboard, just like you used to do in chemistry in high school, with double bonds and single bonds and carbons and nitrogens, a little molecule, usually less than 20 atoms, with a graph structure, can you look at that structure of the molecule and predict what it's going to smell like? Will it even have an odor? Will it smell like roses or rotten eggs? It turns out that's a century or older problem that has been completely unsolved. In general, the way that people try to predict what things smell like is they use little local rules, little local heuristics. And sometimes they work, but mostly they don't. And the question that we asked ourselves is, has all of the progress in machine learning for chemistry that had led up to a point about 5 or 6 years ago, was that enough development for us to take a crack at this problem? And the leap of faith that we took here was not necessarily that machine learning is going to work well in chemistry. That had been demonstrated when we started this work. The leap of faith was, is smell something that you can actually predict, right, are the labels of these molecules. Like if I get a perfumer to smell a molecule and he says, you know, fresh cut grass and ozonic, is that all BS or is that real and stable? And it turns out the world of fragrance, first of all, it's very insular, it's very secretive, but the people that work in it are very good at what they do. And smells are stable, right? You or I might like or dislike a smell, but generally we're actually perceiving the same smell. And so the labels on these molecules are actually stable. And the other kicker here is you can train people, if you get your psychophysics right, which is this whole tiny subdiscipline, you can train people to give you reliable labels of what things smell like. So we took this leap of faith and we solved this very core problem of predicting what a molecule smells like. And we have a paper that we hope to be coming out in a big scientific journal in a few months. But we cracked that. We have superhuman scent prediction performance. It's kind of like passing an odor Turing test. And the way that we validated this is we actually made molecules that had never been smelled before. And we predicted their smell better than people could describe the smell with respect to a panel of people that we trained. And those molecules smell beautiful. And those molecules happen to be products that we're developing on the market as a part of the spin out from Google Research. So stepping back, we're going to give computers a sense of smell. That means reading and mapping and writing smell. Right now, we're really good at mapping and writing at the molecular level, but we're going to get good at all of these three legs of the stool. And when we put them together, that's when smell's digitized.
And the way this technology works, I believe, is similar to the way that people have done this for language, right? Like when you look at how words appear next to each other with some statistical regularity in language, it's a similar idea, but with graphs, right? For like how molecules are structured and how one bond is close to another bond. Like, correct me or challenge me on that there's some similarity in how we've trained some of these other models.
You've got it completely right. And there's a little bit of a step up in complexity here. So with language, a lot of these models are looking at what are the words adjacent to a given word. I'm going to simplify things pretty dramatically because these new models are actually, you know, very powerful. They've got all kinds of extra stuff that make them able to do things beyond what I'm going to describe. But let's say you're focusing on the word your, Y-O-U-R, in the middle of a sentence. You know, it's reasonable to predict that the left and the right word is how is and day. How's your day, right? That's statistically probable. And so anytime the model's focusing on a word, it's learning to pick up the structure of the words around it, and then it can use that pattern to predict like the sentiment analysis of that sentence. Like, is this a positive sentence or a negative sentence? And how's your day is a positive sentence, right? It's similar for molecules, where the model might focus on a given atom in a molecule, like a carbon, and then look at what's next to it. Is it next to a double bond oxygen and another carbon? Is it next to a nitrogen and a sulfur? If it's next to a double bond oxygen, we're dramatically increasing the likelihood that the whole model smells fruity, right? Which is a kind of sentiment analysis in a way. If it's next to a sulfur, we're dramatically increasing the likelihood that the whole molecule smells like rotten eggs, right? So there's these patterns. And instead of looking at a little spotlight in a sentence that's one word to the left and right, our models look at a spotlight that's radius one away from a given atom. And then we actually do this process iteratively and ends up increasing the radius. So we learn a lot of local neighborhood information about these molecules. Those patterns and fragments get aggregated together in a way that, you know, you often lose interpretability in these models. But we learn this neighborhood type pattern recognition approach that gives us the ability in aggregate to predict, is this thing have a smell of a fruit or have a smell of a mushroom or any of another 100 odor labels that we use?
And so I've heard you talk a little bit about compare smell to vision. Vision was obviously solved to this level quite some time ago. Like, what did you learn about smell and how it's similar or how it's different to how vision is represented to machines?
It's a great question. Smell is very different. In some ways, it's more fundamental. It's more, I guess, I don't know if I want to say primitive, but it's evolutionarily much older. So a book I keep on my desk, and we don't have video enabled, but I'll just read you what the title is. It's a book by Hans Moravec called Mind Children. And Moravec was kind of a philosopher type in the, I guess, 50s, 60s, and 70s. And he wrote this book in 1988. The main thing to get from this book is something that is now called Moravec's paradox, which is stated shortly as easy things are hard and hard things are easy. for humans and computers, right? So things that are hard for humans are easy for computers. Things that are easy for humans are hard for computers, right? Like I can't add 100-digit numbers together in a millisecond. A computer can. But there's no computer or robot that can walk across the room and open the door, even at the speed of like an infant, right? It's just total divergence. But the thing is, evolution spent so much more time on motor control than it did on arithmetic, right? So we've got the machinery for these things that are really hard for computers. Evolution has spent so much time on smell. It is privileged. If you look inside of the brain, smell is a different and privileged sense. First of all, it's the first olfactory nerve, right? And it skips all of these other way stations and processing steps that go on for other senses. So every other sense, even if you touch the skin right on front of your nose, it takes longer for that sensation to reach your consciousness than for you to be aware of the smells that enter your nose. Because there's just fewer synapses from the periphery, from the world, into the areas of your brain that you can pay attention to, or that can enter into consciousness. Also, the signals from the nose go directly to two areas of the brain that are very important. The hippocampus, which is largely responsible for memory and memory formation, and the amygdala, which is the seat of a lot of different kinds of emotions. I'm simplifying, but smell is so powerful in terms of memory and is so powerful in terms of emotion because it's wired that way. The other thing for the more computationally minded is vision. We don't really see with our eyes. This is something I learned from a neuroscientist I admire very, very deeply, Jim DiCarlo. And he makes this point. We don't really see with our eyes. We see with our brains. The information that comes into our retina is almost unusable. And there's many, many steps of very complicated processing happening every single moment you are alive that constructs our understanding of objects, of depth, of color, of shadow, of everything. Those are all computationally constructed senses. And of course, the raw information from the retina is indispensable for that, but the eye itself doesn't do that for us. The nose is different. A lot of what happens computationally in vision happens just physically in the nose. There's so many fewer computational steps before this information reaches awareness. In the way that the nose is constructed, almost all this fancy computational stuff is just part of the sense, right? Like the molecules are either hitting your nose or they're not. And, you know, again, to get a little bit nerdier, there's this notion of competitive inhibition or, you know, center surround effects that's a really big part of constructing, you know, filter banks in the brain. And all that stuff actually is implemented physically in the nose. There's competition for the receptors at the molecular level in the nose. So it's different. It's older. It's more emotionally powerful. It's more directly tied to memory. So I think the greatest among equals of the senses, but I'm biased.
Yeah, no, well, so you've cracked this problem. You can teach machines to smell, which is pretty amazing, but it opens up so many possible business opportunities. I'm curious, like, how have you decided where to focus initially, what kinds of things you're working on? And then I'm also curious, like, has anybody reached out with a really unusual or surprising request for something to use this for?
Well, what we've learned is the kinds of smells that the world is made of in the industrial sense are actually not all the smells that we can experience. That's been the most surprising thing in the journey is all of these smells that end up in our products like shampoos and conditioners and hand soaps and fine fragrances and, you know, room diffusers, it's such a tiny slice of the smells that are out there. And to me, that's astounding because in the industry of vision and in hearing, there's so many more sounds and sights in the digital world than even exist in the world, right? Like the world doesn't contain the fantasies that we dream up and put into images and that we dream up and put into music and into soundscapes or into movies. But for perfume, there's less diversity. There's less richness in the world of industrial fragrance than there is out there in the world. And that gap, I think, is an opportunity, right? So that's been one of the more surprising things that we've learned.
Interesting. And so since you started this company, probably one of the most interesting things that's happened in AI is the release of ChatGPT. So I'm curious, has the LLM craze and ChatGPT changed at all how you think about what you might do with this or any opportunities to integrate with them.
I think the explosion of availability and of quality of language models, particularly this large language model wave, it's astounding, right? We're always looking for ways to integrate this. And we've got folks that are dedicated at the company just to figuring out, hey, what's the right way to think about this stuff? The short answer for chemistry is the jury is out. Undoubtedly, natural language interfaces are going to be plugged into more and more of the complicated tools that we have that have weird ergonomics. So instead of, you know, using some complicated user interface that might be unfriendly, in the future, I'll be able to just talk to a lot of the systems that we have. Still early days, though. Now, the engine behind these LLMs, you know, the algorithm called the Transformer, which is itself the culmination of a bunch of back and forth between industry and academia. But I think we're celebrating an anniversary of that paper, actually, recently by Ashish Vaswani and colleagues at Google Brain. So I was fortunate enough to work with those folks while I was there. That Transformer seems to be a new kind of universal pattern recognizer, right? So that's the new cognitive engine that seems to be useful across modalities. And so that algorithm itself is something that we look at very carefully, and we use that where we've got enough data to actually make the engine go. So, you know, these developments are picking up pace. As for whether or not, you know, using ChatGPT directly or Bard or other LLMs directly in our work, it's still early days because we're a bit far afield of just normal text processing.
Gotcha. So a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this podcast. And so one of the things I always like to ask people that are working in interesting spaces is, what is a technical problem that maybe you're not working on at Osmo, but that you wish somebody else would solve to make your life easier for the stuff that you do?
Gosh, that's a really interesting question. I would like to be able to talk to my company as if it were a living, breathing thing. I would like all of these LLMs to be able to ingest we're a very documentation heavy culture. We write down what we think. We write down what we're planning. We communicate in a written form. The company contains enough information to train a chatbot that could have a personality that could be interacted with. And I could ask Osmo, hey, where are the opportunities where we're not focusing? Where are there problems that require my attention or other people's attention? Where are the things that we're excited about? You know, right now, I don't think anybody can talk to anything other than a living individual. But now we know that these chatbots pass the Turing test, which is amazing, by the way. I mean, we've just blown past that, by the way. We've passed the Turing test. And the knowledge that they're trained on is, you know, the entire internet. It's the pool of information available to our species. But could we specialize some of these chatbot personalities to reflect the knowledge pool, you know, like private knowledge pools? And those private knowledge pools are firms, right? Or they're groups or they're corporations. So I think that would be super cool. I think it would be a massive productivity and managerial win. And I hope somebody builds this.
Yeah, awesome. I have not heard anybody working on that, but I'm sure someone out there is, and we'll hear about it soon. This has been fascinating. I like to end with a more personal question because, you know, obviously you've had some success in your career and have probably met a lot of successful people, read a lot of interesting stuff. So I'm always curious, like, what's one piece of life advice that you've learned along the way from a book or a mentor or a colleague that you just sort of like to share with, you know, with the group that's listening?
There's so many things, and they're all going to be very personal to me as my personality has had to change in order to take whatever the next step at that point is. What I collect a lot of quotes, and then I usually keep some of those quotes at the top of like a working page I call Workbench, which has got, you know, quotes that kind of keep me grounded or kind of keep my perspective shifted in some way. I want to change it. And then I write down in that note also what my main focus is. So like, what are my priorities? And those don't get checked off very often because they're often hard things to do. And then more tactical things and links to notes that I'm working on. So this is kind of like my cockpit for how I like run my day, run my week, run my month. And I can just read to you the quotes that are on top of this. I won't censor them. This is just kind of the things that I'm thinking about that I'm currently trying to shift my perspective around.
Sure.
The first is, you know, just go big, go for the real thing, whatever that is. Like, don't minimize, don't do incremental, call out what the big thing is that you're doing and do it and learn by doing. So what I just wrote is go big, go for the real thing, learn by doing. And then there's three quotes from different folks. One's from a book called Extreme Ownership, which I really like. And the quote is, a true leader is not intimidated when others step up and take charge. And what I'm really loving about Osmo is my leaders are stepping up and they're taking major ownership of really complicated initiatives. And I love that. The other is from a biography of Thomas Edison. This one really resonates, and I have to keep reminding myself of this all the time. No great end can be obtained without considerable doubt and tribulation. Problems are the rule, not the exception. And then a quote I just added recently, because I think it's kind of beautiful, it's by Mario Cuomo. You campaign in poetry, you govern in prose. And those are the things that I'm thinking of that I'm kind of feeding my brain every time I open this note.
Yeah, those are really great. I love the Edison quote. I've heard that one before, and I think it applies a lot to startups. Yeah, and I know as we've talked about your journey and my journey and all that kind of stuff, doing this stuff, it's a lot of ups and downs, but also a lot of fun. And you know, it's just great stuff to go through at the end of the day. Well, Alex, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. For people listening, if you want to learn more, you can go to osmo.ai. Check out the company. And as always, we hope you listen to our other episodes. If you have ideas for guests, please email me at rob@ai-innovators.com, and we'll see you again next week.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure to speak today.